Call to order the House Judiciary Committee meeting at 1:05 on Monday morning, the 18th of March. Present, Representatives Betty Davis, Representatives Tuohy, Bundy, Green, and myself, Representative Porter. Representative Veazey and Finkelstein should be joining us momentarily. We have four bills for consideration and one confirmation. The first confirmation and only confirmation that we have is the confirmation of Sharon Nahorny to the Commission of got it right here. Judicial conduct, yes. Couldn't be more appropriate since she's the director of the Court Watch program in Anchorage. But I'll let her tell us about that. Sharon, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Sharon, hi. Would you, for the record, give us your name and address, and if you'd like, a brief comment about your appointment to this board?
All right, I surely would be happy to. Sharon Nahorny, I'm sorry, did you say spelling too?
No, we've got it.
Okay. Address is 619 East 5th Avenue, and that's Victims for Justice, Anchorage 99501. I'm very pleased that Governor Knowles has asked me to be on the Alaska Judicial Conduct Commission once again. I have served 4 years on this commission. I found it educational, informative, but I feel that my position with the Court Watch program and with Victims for Justice has really been beneficial because I have a unique perspective from the public to bring to that forum. We evaluate ethics conditions, obviously, of judges, and you see the public in such a unique perspective from not only the Court Watch program but from Victims for Justice that I feel very good in being able to bring that resource to the Conduct Commission. So I would ask the legislature to confirm me. I feel that I am a benefit from my viewpoint, and I have enjoyed serving on this and feel that this public entity is just absolutely vital. I've seen a lot of changes in the format since I have started with the commission. I feel that people are treated a lot more fairly, with more dignity and respect. Just having more vocal people on the commission, I think it's made a big difference. And so for that reason, as well as others that I sure shouldn't take time to mention, I would request your confirmation.
Thank you, Sharon. Are there any questions?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sharon, I'm delighted you're going to accept this again. I think we're a better state for your oversight all the way around. Thank you very much for your dedication and diligence in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tuohy.
Representative Tuohy, would you like to turn that into a motion?
Yes, I'd be delighted. I move that we, I don't know that we pass it, but we, what do? We sign our names and
move this from our committee recommending
wouldn't have said it better.
Considered for the House floor. Sharon, thank you much for being with us, and we'll forward it on.
Thank you so much.
You bet.
Appreciate it.
And there it is.
Wonderful. Thank you.
The first bill for consideration then, and I guess for those in the audience, I will let you know that the bills were going to come in order that they are on the schedule. HB 493, involuntary alcohol commitments, then 479, then 318, and then, if we're really on a roll, 359. So, 493 is a bill that we have heard once. Representative Ivan, welcome back.
Thank you, General Porter and the committee members for taking up House Bill 493. Involuntary commitment for public inebriates who have alcohol or drug abuse problems. And there were a number of concerns expressed by the court system and others concerning this bill. And these concerns have been addressed by my staff, Shannon O'Fallon from the Department of Law, Warren Jewell from the Division of Alcohol and Drug Abuse, Steve Hamilton, and Don Dapovich from the Governor's Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, Tom Meyer from Representative Porter's staff, and Mike Ford of Legal Services, and Barbara Carver from the City of Juneau's Attorney's Office. I would prefer that Don Dapovich discuss the changes made in the draft before you dated March 14, 1996, and we can proceed as such. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ivan. Representative Green.
We have not adopted this version.
We have not? We certainly
could. I would move that we would adopt version G, 31496 forward for CS for House Bill 493 as our working document.
And a motion to adopt version G, dated 31496 of HB 493 as our working document. Is there objection? Not. That is the document in front of us. We have one person at least here to testify. We have people from the division and others that can talk to the amendments. From just a general overview, I can tell you that the concerns of the court system were looked at, and Tom Meyer from our staff and the sponsor staff worked with the agencies, and I think have come up with a bill that generally meets most of the requirements. So perhaps we can get, we have Barbara Brink from the Public Defender's Office that would like to testify. I don't have anyone else signed up, but when we get into consideration, perhaps we'll find need for questions of other people. Barbara, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Could we have your name and affiliation for the record and your testimony, please?
Thank you. My name is Barbara Brink. I'm with the Alaska Public Defender Agency, where I've been an attorney for the past 13 years. My address is 900 West Fifth Avenue, Suite 200, here in Anchorage. I appreciate all of the input that the various members have had in a bill that was passed constitutional muster, but I must express that I still have some legal concerns whether or not this bill would violate constitutional due process. And it may be a problem that is simply beyond our fixing. I believe the impetus for this bill is to make it easier for those professionals engaged in alcohol and drug abuse treatment and concerned family and friends to involuntarily commit someone so that they must participate in such a treatment. Normally, before the state can lock up somebody against their will, they have to prove that the state has a valid and strong interest in locking that person up, because the fundamental right to liberty requires strict scrutiny. That means the person's interest in remaining at large and being at liberty has to be balanced against the state's interest in curtailing that liberty. The previous standard requires that a person had to be demonstrably shown to be dangerous to themselves or others, and the previous language in the statute required some proof regarding likelihood of infliction of physical harm on another person. That's why it was so difficult to lock somebody up, to require them to have treatment against their will. That is a difficult standard to meet. The current standard in this bill, in the CS that was just adopted, I believe is worded so broadly that it has due process problems. And I think dangerousness is a constitutional requirement that this bill does not require. For example, a person is defined to be incapacitated by alcohol or drugs simply if their judgment is so impaired that they are not making rational decisions regarding their treatment. That would include basically anybody who is a user or an abuser who does not want to go to treatment. Secondly, the second prong of the test is whether or not they're at risk of serious physical harm or illness unless committed. And it's the or illness prong that causes me some concern. Interpreted broadly, this would include someone who smokes two packs of cigarettes a day. They are certainly placing themselves at serious risk of harm or illness. They have demonstrated an increased tolerance for cigarettes and the drugs contained in them. They suffer from withdrawal, and it is a significant hazard to their health. So taking the language of this bill at face value, I think it is not strict enough to pass constitutional muster. There are also some procedural safeguards that are missing. For example, in a civil commitment proceeding, the state has to prove by clear and convincing evidence. They have to place someone at the very closest facility available. They're entitled to hearings. And I bill does correct the hearing problem. They're now entitled to a hearing. I'm sorry, the bill should correct the hearing problem, because under a mental health commitment, they're entitled to a hearing within 72 hours. And as I read the CS, it can be up to 10 days after the hearing. For all those reasons, I have legal concerns about the bill, but as a public defender, I also have some policy concerns. We're talking about a very valuable and limited treatment facility. I have represented many people who would fall within these definitions of alcoholic or drug abuser. My own personal experience is simply that those people who are going to benefit from treatment are those who find it within themselves, who are self-motivated, and finally reach that point in their lives when they actively seek out the treatment themselves. What we are doing is we are forcing people who are not at that point into those limited treatment beds, is we are taking those options away from those people who might most benefit from them. And I think that the success rates for treatment bear out my personal experience. The people who actively seek it out and are willing and able are those people who benefit from that treatment. I also think that we may have an unfair impact on our rural citizens. In many small villages and towns, there are no facilities available, and I will wrap up here. The impact of this bill could be to take someone out of their home village, ship them to Anchorage where service is available, where they don't know anybody, have no resources, and will not likely be successful. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Barbara. Are there any questions, Representative Finkelstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Barbara, in your experience, aren't we to some degree putting people through treatment now? It's just a different form of treatment that, I mean, depending where they are in the state, don't they go through some sort of being picked up by patrol, through a detox program if it exists, sort of being cycled through the system, jail in some areas? Isn't all that involuntary as well?
It is, but that sort of commitment, Representative Finkelstein, is for a very limited period of time, up to 12 hours, only until they are no longer so incapacitated that they basically don't have their wits about them. And in my experience, I understand that Juno has used the current involuntary civil commitment procedure to try to force treatment on other people, but it has not been found to be a workable solution in other communities. So I think that they are being what we call PC, placed in protective custody, for their own very, very short-term immediate safety, and that's all.
Follow-up, Representative Finkelstein.
I thought the detox treatment was 3 days in Anchorage.
They can be required to stay up to 72 hours. They're entitled to a hearing within 72 hours if someone files a petition.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Toohey?
Thank you. Barbara, I absolutely agree with you 100% on the fact that we have gone around this circle a thousand times. Unless somebody wants to stop drinking, it's pointless to put them anywhere. And I think that you're right, the cost of this is going to be prohibitive. I don't see a fiscal note with this new CS. And I applaud Representative Ivins' desire to help every drunk that's out there. We all want to help them. They're pathetic. But you can't get a horse, you can take him to water, but you can't get him to drink. And it's, you know, and I just have a real problem with this. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Oh, great.
Tom, is there anybody from the agency that would like to go through the bill, maybe?
Mr. Chairman, Shannon O'Fallon and Don Dabsevich are both here, and they've done extensive work on this bill.
Could we perhaps get a response to the constitutional issues, at least?
Go through the bill.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Shannon O'Fallon from the Attorney General's Office in the Human Services Section. Ms. Brink is correct. The Supreme Court does require some level of dangerousness in order for the state to commit someone. The Supreme Court has addressed that issue in the context of mental health issues, and I would imagine it's the same if you've got someone that's suffering from a mental illness or someone that's suffering from alcoholism or drug abuse, to the extent that it's either making them a danger to themselves or to others, or is incapacitating them to the level that they can't care for themselves. And I think the state's interest in treating them and forcing them into treatment meets the constitutional requirements. And Ms. Brink may also be right that in the definition of incapacitated by alcohol or drugs, it may be that we need to change an or there to and. I just spoke with with Don about that.
Would you state the page and the line number?
Certainly.
That you're talking about?
I'm page 7, line 22. It probably didn't catch this before. It's probably not enough to have someone be incapacitated by alcohol or drugs and incapable of making rational decisions for treatment. That probably is not enough to commit someone. There then has to be another level that they're unable to care for their basic needs. So if you change this "or" after the word "treatment" to "and," then that should be sufficient. I mean, there's the level of dangerousness that we're talking about there is that they're going to be unable to take care of themselves. They're dangerous to themselves at that level. And so I think that that would take care of some of Ms. Brink's concern. The issue that she brought up before about them having to prove a danger to others under the previous standard is not true. It was an or situation as well. It was incapacitated by alcohol or a danger to others. You didn't have to have both.
Representative Tui?
A question, and referring to the group I know best, the group on 4th Avenue over the you know, down in some of the areas that have wooded facilities. These people are living in tents. Again, line 22, page 7. Persons' basic safety or personal needs, including food, clothing, shelter, or medical care. My objective of food, clothing, and medical care is not the same as everybody's.
Right.
And there are people living in tents or living, eating out of, whatever. That is not my norm, but it is certainly a norm for them. And that's the kind of thing that bothers me. I'll say no more for a while.
I don't believe that for 1 minute.
I think that the amendment that Department of Law has brought up is small enough and manageable enough to be dealt with here. Representative Bundy?
So moved.
We've had a motion then to amend the bill on page 7, line 22, to delete the word "or" and replace it with the word "and." Is there objection to the motion? Not, the motion passes. I've just been handed, there's 2 other people on the teleconference that wish to provide testimony. If we could keep you guys here and perhaps get some more input, that's going to generate some more discussion. So if we could go to Valdez and ask if Dirk Nelson is ready to testify.
Yes, I am. I'm here today on one hand representing the Alaska Civil Liberties Union, and I'm also here representing myself with another portion of my statement if we have time for that. I appreciate your committee's willingness to hear this testimony. The Alaska Civil Liberties Union opposes this bill on grounds that it expands the scope of the statute for alcohol to drugs without clearly defining what are drugs. If my child becomes hyperactive and is certainly unable to manage his behavior as a result of a secret sugar intake, may I now have him committed? It removes harm to others as a standard. And being a licensed clinical social worker and a licensed marital and family therapist and having participated in a great number of ex parte hearings. Traditionally, my understanding has been that the words "gravely disabled" were the standard, and that "gravely disabled" both applied to your ability to function in meeting your needs or your potential harm to yourself or others in an imminent sort of way. It removes the right to a jury trial in the first phase, or at least the most recent reading that I read did. And it changed the period of time that you could be committed, or for lack of a better word, incarcerated, from 90 to 180 days. I appreciated the testimony of Ms. Brink. It shared a great number of points with mine. And the comments by Ms. Tui. I'd now like to depart and launch into a statement that I've written on my own, which I'll now separate from my representation of the Alaska Civil Liberties Union, and will simply be my viewpoint on this as a professional in this field, and that is that within CS HB 493, and especially the original draft HB 493, there is disparity regarding the target populations. We refer to alcoholics with an implication of physical dependence. On the other hand, we refer to drug abusers where there is no indication of physical addiction or dependence, and where there's a great deal of disparity in defining what is a drug abuser. Is a person who smokes a joint on Saturday a drug abuser? Not under the state of Alaska's constitution, he's not. Drug treatment as a service is questionable at best regarding its success. Alaska has no scientific data, data of scientific caliber regarding the effectiveness. However, the Liverpool Project in England, where 100% pure cocaine and heroin are prescribed to addicts by physicians, has gathered some interesting data. Most importantly, they found that studies of groups of addicts, those who seek traditional treatment, such as inpatient clinics, and those who continue to use 100% pure synthesized narcotics prescribed by a physician and with clean, sterile equipment, that over a 10-year period, the rates of recovery are nearly identical for both groups. One group costs $8 a day in pure cocaine or heroin. The other group costs up to a couple thousand dollars a day for a lot of fluff. drug users are currently the most systemically discriminated against group in our society, despite constitutional rulings stating, for example, that marijuana cultivation or use in private is not a state legal issue. Inaccurate data has been used in the Lutke versus Neighbors and the Treasury Bureau and other urine testing cases that have depicted drug users as greatly responsible for costs to the economic system. The study that was used in that was the Firestone study. And in fact, the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company study didn't involve drug using employees. It was a study of alcoholic employees. Okay, so there's been a lot of rhetoric and PR that's gone into these efforts for a variety of reasons. Language in this bill states that a refusal of a physical exam will not be used as evidence of lack of judgment, yet it mandates that this evidence be entered into the petition and later considered. You know, either it's counted or it's not. Despite an apparent attempt to better define the original and poorly constructed language in this bill, there remains a great deal of room for interpretation, and it's this very kind of interpretation that I fear later becomes put to misuse in the hands of the powers that be. And from my own experience, I've encountered a number of law enforcement officers that as the laws multiply in terms of quantity of legislation, I can introduce you today to several police officers who would have a difficult time defining a great number of laws, and they've more resorted simply to keeping the peace because there's too many laws for them to know what they are. Inability to hold a job might be perceived under this bill to include anyone who was terminated for a urine test without taking into account whether or not they were legally eligible to be tested in the first place, or whether their position was truly a safety-sensitive job as mandated by the United States Supreme Court, in that urine testing, et cetera, is still search and seizure according to the court. And so,
Mr. Nelson, could you summarize, please?
Hold employment, is that by your doing, or is that by the doing of someone
yeah,
else
hear you.
Who maybe knows you don't have the money
take a breath,
to hire an attorney to fight an invalid search?
Mr. Nelson?
And certainly, if you're terminated, there's certainly evidence there that you're having difficulty
holding
a job. But is that by your conduct, or is that by someone else's intrusiveness into the contents of your urine?
Mr. Nelson,
okay. Could
you summarize, please?
I'm almost completed here. Previous court decisions have indicated that that forced medical care is not to be administered without there being some degree of imminent danger of harm to self or others. Is there room within this bill? And I saw some statements regarding immunity from civil action. I'm wondering if someone is wrongly locked up by testimony of a family member per se. And I have seen ex parte hearings go on where a family member who was not legitimately incapacitated in fact had a warrant put upon them by a family member because the family member wanted them institutionalized even though they didn't meet the criteria. In those cases, is there room for civil action for damages within this legislation? There's the cost issue. Does this cover people who are addicted to high-fat foods? As a last statement, I wanted to include some mortality rates here for your committee to consider. mortality rates put some of these issues in a greater perspective than some of the PR and rhetoric that we hear frequently on the news. Heart disease in this country kills well over 500,000, and yet we're not jailing people for eating fried chicken. Tobacco kills 450,000 people a year, and we're still subsidizing them. Alcohol kills 158,000 people a year, and we're still taking money from them. And illicit substances combined kill approximately 11,000 people per year, a mere pittance in contrast to the others, and yet we seem to be pursuing those people with a vigor, down to taking away their jobs and locking them in institutions. I'm greatly concerned about the intent of this bill. I know that there are difficulties with people who are severely addicted to crack or who are severely addicted to alcohol, but I would recommend that we narrow the wording in this legislation significantly in order that it might perpetuate the true intent of past Supreme Court rulings regarding civil liberties and freedom. Thanks very much for your time.
Mr. Chair. You betcha. Representative Bundy.
Yes, I have a question. Several times, sir, you mentioned the criteria of being a danger to self or others. As a, I think you said, a family therapist, have you known instances where chronic alcoholics were a danger to the mental health of others, particularly their family?
Yes, I have. Unfortunately, that doesn't meet the criteria or the intent of the law in that, you know, for me, listening to various political speeches is a danger to my mental health. And that certainly doesn't allow me the opportunity to go lock that person up.
It's a concern I share with you. I've recently experienced that.
Mr. Nelson, I wish you wouldn't provide so many straight lines. Are there any other questions? I see none. We have one other person, Kathy Burns in Nome. Kathy?
Yeah.
Kathy, I'm going to ask that you try not to be quite as vociferous as the last witness, could we have your name and address and your testimony, please?
My name is Kathy Burns. I'm in Nome. I'm the clinical director for Northern Lights Recovery Center. I'm here representing the Norton Sound region and our concerns about the bill. Here, Norton Sound has the highest suicide rate in the state of Alaska. This rate does not include the drownings or the environmental deaths. Our environmental deaths, 85% are from excessive cold and are alcohol related. We have the second highest homicide rate in the state. We have the third highest poisoning death rate in the state. 76% of those are poisoning deaths that are alcohol related. We have the highest firearm death rate in Alaska, and suicides represent 65.2% of the firearm deaths, and again, of the suicide rate, majority of those are alcohol related. We have 49 times higher alcohol and drug related deaths than in the lower 48. Our concern here is that we have a great deal of alcohol problems here in the region, as I'm sure you're aware of. We do not have a detox facility available to our region. Of this bill, what we'd like to see is that there could be some consideration. When I speak to my physicians here in the region about this bill, their concern is that it's a great burden on physicians' time, and we were wondering if there could be some kind of consideration to word it somewhat like the Title 47 bill, where perhaps licensed clinical social workers or some other qualified personnel could be added in providing some of the court testimony or some of the workload so that our physicians will not be overwhelmed with this particular issue. That's it, short and sweet.
Okay, thank you very much. Could we perhaps get a response to those two issues?
The last two issues? I believe under 4737-170, a physician's assistant can do an evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
actually under regulation. The regulation site is 7 AAC 29080, that states that an individual performing duties under AS 4737-170C as a qualified health practitioner must hold a valid license under AS08 as a physician, physician's assistant, or nurse practitioner. And so under one section of the statute, is that the 41 hour?
That's for the 12 hour.
For the 12 hour holds, someone other than a physician can do evaluation.
12 to 48 hours.
Perhaps Don could speak to whether or not you'd want to broaden the definition of who can do that.
Part of, without a doubt, the clinical social worker or a credentialed chemical dependency person can very well provide the clinical data, behavioral clinical data. However, in most cases, we're dealing with people who are severely debilitated medically as a result of their use of alcohol or drugs. And generally, you want a medical practitioner to speak to the organicity issues if they're they've got decreased liver functioning or kidney problems or Korsakoff syndrome or Wernicke's. We're talking about people who are severely debilitated medically, the ones that are targeted in this bill. And generally speaking, you'll want to have, although I recognize the concerns of the caller, especially in rural communities, to protect the rights of the person, the client being committed, you pretty much have an obligation to have a medical person examine and provide input to the courts.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could add, under the mental commitments under Title 47, in order to commit someone for 30 days, you have to have a physician involved in that process, a psychiatrist or a physician.
Tui, you have a question?
Thank you. Yes. Page 2, line 22. third alternative for a maximum of 12 hours, whichever occurs first. You're talking about small communities that have village health aides that are qualified, very qualified to go on that list with physicians, assistants, and nurse practitioners, I think, to start initiate this treatment. But I understand you're only, you have in some cases only a 12-hour time frame in there. Once they sober up.
The 12-hour time frame is the limited time that a person can be held in protective custody by the jail. And that's based, really, that figure, that 12-hour figure is based on a clinical rather than administrative thing. They don't want to keep people in jail who are entering withdrawal. And generally speaking, withdrawal begins at a point about 12 hours. So that's the 12-hour hold. That's for protective custody in a jail, as opposed to in a detox facility, where it can go up to 72 hours.
Thank you. And just one quick more question. Until a person is no longer intoxicated or incapacitated by alcohol or drugs, and at that time he can say, I don't want treatment, leave me alone, I'm out of here, is that permissible?
Absolutely. The involuntary commitment part of the statute is to target those people like one in Fairbanks here who had 170 12-hour holds in the local jail. I don't know how many detox at the detox facility and aborted treatment a time or two. These are people, if you total up those days, they're involved in either the judicial system or the medical system almost on a daily basis. I did a commitment several years back on an individual who had 103 detox episodes. These are extremely time-consuming, extremely expensive, and we would do far better to use our less expensive treatment dollars to treat those folks than to continually cycle them through a detox or a jail, a community jail.
Representative Finkelstein?
But this section we're talking about here on page 2, this isn't what the bill's about.
No.
This is a completely different section. So right. The under involuntary commitment, what this bill's about, they don't have any choice. They don't get the choices you're describing here. So this just happens to be in the
still because of that one conforming amendment. They don't have any choice.
It may be somewhat confusing. What we attempted to do in the last go-round at your instruction was to pull in the interested parties and to make the rest of the statute, not those portions necessarily involved with involuntary commitment, to make them consistent. And so we did make some slight changes in the other sections, those dealing with the 12-hour holds and such, just to make the language consistent to the statutes. We made no substantive changes in those other portions of the statute.
One of the people testifying had a concern about the definition of drug abuser.
The definition
someone
is
who
consistent.
Uses too much sugar, drug abuse.
The definition is consistent with alcohol. They had, I think they were speaking to the title and act related to treatment of alcoholism or drug abuse. The definition within the statute is consistent between alcohol and drug abuse and specifically speaks to drug addiction.
That was my impression, but I wanted to get that on the record. Representative Finkelstein?
Where does it speak to drug addiction?
Under 180, is it in front of
you? Well, the definition is 7.
Page 7.
Page 7,
section 13.
Right, that was the section that the person was speaking to and demonstrates increased tolerance. I mean, the point is, how can you say that this doesn't apply to a broad set of drugs, including...
These are the definitions of addiction. Increased
right.
tolerance, withdrawal, organicity.
Right. The person testifying was asking how you differentiate this from nicotine to crack cocaine. Don't they both fall into it?
Well, the different crack cocaine, on one hand, has the component dealing with unable to make rational decisions because of impaired mental functioning. Nicotine has no impaired mental functioning.
Mr. Chairman, I take exception to that. You never tried to quit.
I didn't speak to trying to quit or addiction. I spoke to legal or to mental functioning on ability to make decisions for the need for treatment.
Is there anything to follow?
I think it's all arguable. I think the decision to, if you're addicted to a substance and you know it's going to kill you, I don't know if that's a rational decision. And you continue to do it. I think the point was made, a lot of things can fall into this, and I think it was correct. Relating it to where the definition comes in on page 3, I share the concerns expressed about this. Category is, this person's got to be alcoholic or drug abuser, which just means they have some addiction level, and they then must be either incapacitated, and that could be just for the afternoon, right?
Right.
It could be that they're on drugs and they're non-functioning at that point or whatever, or they have to be at risk of serious physical harm or illness, which plenty of drugs, including all sorts of things, legal and illegal, certainly constitute serious physical harm. Isn't this a pretty broad category when you apply it to the world of drugs that people are consuming, legal and illegal?
The referral early on is for the issue of removing them from physical harm that you would do in a 12-hour hold, which you may do with someone who is not addicted to alcohol or drugs, or that needs services because they are not able to fend for themselves in terms of their own safety, walk out in front of vehicles and such. That does not speak to addiction at all, and that is early in the statute and speaks only to that protective custody. Then later on, we're speaking about involuntary commitment, which is a different portion of the statute and is used in those cases where there is both all of the markers for addiction and the other portion, and we just added that and the other portion, dealing with the ability to provide for their own safety.
Chairman?
Representative Finkelstein, follow up once.
Well, this is the heart of the point here, right? I mean, this is the issue before us, and I was just reading, I wasn't reading from the other section, I'm reading from the involuntary commitment section. I still don't see how you're making this differentiation, and I'm picking nicotine only because it's a legal substance. It meets the requirements for addiction, no doubt about it, and under this section, they have to either be incapacitated, which they aren't, or who, if not treated, will be at risk of serious physical harm or illness. Is someone who's smoking 4 packs a day not at risk of serious physical harm or illness? Don't they fall under this category?
I think that they fall into the category with regard to meeting the need for addicted, but I...
It says or, either incapacitated or at risk of serious physical harm or illness.
Well, they're looking that up. President Beasley, did you have a...
Yes.
I intend to follow that up, David.
In this definition that we're establishing here, it talks about an alcoholic or a drug user person that shows symptoms of increased tolerance. I mean, that kind of flies in the face of all the knowledge I have of alcoholism. Alcoholics I know of can get intoxicated on smaller and smaller amounts as their liver deteriorates and their body's ability to metabolize it deteriorates.
That's correct. In the very late stages, there is a time at which you'll have some decrease or you'll have some decrease in tolerance. That's correct. Whether it is substantial enough to, I don't think that legally it would make a difference to specify that population. For that bump that occurred.
Well, you're using the term late stage, and I would just call it the advanced stage because that stage goes on for a long, long time. I mean,
would I be correct that when you added drug abuse to this, that you had in mind illicit drugs, illegal drugs?
Yes.
Schedule, whatever the heck that is, of the federal. Could we not add that someplace so that that's clear that that's what it is that we're intending here rather than to get off on these somewhat ridiculous but still within the law?
Good sense to me.
Would it be a simple matter, those of you who are familiar with the construction of the bill, to add illicit drugs or a term like that to the appropriate places here? Would a conceptual amendment be appropriate, or is this something we'd have to...
Is that in the definition section, Mr. Chair?
Representative Finkelstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that point, the abuse of prescription drugs is a major drug problem that... You know, in certain communities is as large a scale as the abuse of illegal drugs. Many drugs that are illegal are available under prescription.
But those are controlled substance drugs. Yeah, I didn't really mean illicit.
Right.
Controlled substance drugs, right, is the one that I'm trying to come up with.
Which excludes prescription.
No, prescription or controlled substance, they are allowable with prescription, but they're still illegal without the prescription. So the term that I'm looking for, I guess, is controlled substance drugs rather than...
It is. My point, Mr. Chairman, is just that the people are addicted to prescription drugs just as they're addicted to alcohol or illegal drugs and have the same sort of problems that I'm trying to get off and pose the same dangers to themselves. I don't know, it's just a hard differentiation for me to make.
It's not one I think that's why they're adding it. It isn't one that they're asking you to make. It is that there are some people who drink every day who don't yet fall into the problem, although probably most of them will if they keep that up, of having an inability to control their own actions and the rest of the definition.
there are people who are given a prescription for a controlled substance drug who take it as provided by the prescription and also don't end up with any other kinds of ability to control themselves problems that would put them into the full definition of this and susceptible. But there are people who have an alcohol and drug abuse problem, people with just an alcohol problem, and people with just a drug abuse problem that fall into the category of those who we can treat them now or treat them later. It's just a matter of time. So I would entertain then a motion to Representative Bundy.
On a conceptual motion to include controlled substances as the focus of this bill.
As opposed to just drugs or drug abuser at the appropriate places. Does the committee understand the conceptual amendment? Representative Finkelstein?
So generally, where it says drugs, we're going to take a drugs and put it in controlled substance drugs. Is that the concept here?
Basically, and within that definition, make sure that it's understandable.
It'll be in the definition. When what we'll do is in the definition section, we'll say controlled substances and give the definition of controlled substances. And when you see drug abuse, this is what it means.
Okay. Is there objection into that conceptual amendment? Not, we'll call that amendment number 2, and that amendment passes. Questions.
Okay, he's here for question. Who's going to go over the bill? What I've heard given to me at this point doesn't sound any different. In fact, what it does is broaden the scope of who can be considered for a volunteer, involuntary placement into drug treatment programs under the new CS that we have. Mm-hmm. I don't know what problems it addressed that we talked about in the last time when we heard this bill. Said lots of people came together and they did a lot of work on it. I want to know what work they did. Other than what you just said, I haven't heard anything. It does not address the fact that this is taking one category of people over another category of people and taking up the bed space now that's already limited to give it to those people that we are now going to place there involuntarily. And it does not address the fact that there's not enough beds, even though that was discussed the last time that there was a problem. I think this bill that we have before us now make it even worse.
Well, I think that's a policy decision question, but to the extent that changes were made in the bill, all I tell you, could you basically give us what the bill does
different from the other
as compared to existing law, not necessarily with previous renditions of a bill, but what does this bill do to change existing law?
Okay, basically our aim in this, and I think those aims were met, was to base the commitment on sound clinical measures rather than the social issues that it addressed before that were very vague and in fact may not have been connected directly to drug or alcohol addiction. It ensured that the courts have the latitude necessary to make decisions, treatment decisions that are appropriate to the severity of the problem that's come before them, and with reasonable expectation of success. And I think that it protects the rights of the clients. It's more consistent now than it was before with regard to the mental health commitments versus the alcohol and now other drug abuse commitments. And basically that's the issues that we were concerned about, and we think we met those, and that made it more user-friendly for treatment programs, especially in the bush, to initiate commitments. Now with respect to how much this will change the status quo, initially probably not at all. It'll take a period of time, in fact years, to effect the change necessary to have that long impact on treatment programs. First of all, it's treatment people who are bringing would bring 99% of them, and they're not going to bring a commitment if they don't have a bed available to put the person in. So it's self-limiting somewhat in that. So I think that it's a workable solution. It's one that's going to take more steps along the way to tailor treatment better, to train the courts, to train the medical folks, and to train the treatment professionals around the state to use it. And it's something we're looking at 5-10 years down the road rather than something that's going to dramatically change the system overnight.
Would it be a fair question that the expansion of the involuntary commitment time is not an absolute but an allowance?
It's an allowable.
On an individual basis?
Exactly.
Are there any further questions, Representative Finkelstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of my concerns is, since this process can be initiated by a relative that it wouldn't be used to sort of solve internal disputes or family disputes or just domestic disputes where you basically mad at someone. Plenty of people are alcoholics, and so the ones who tend to get sent in and they meet these requirements, because alcoholics are addicts and they're a threat to themselves and they're incapacitated, that the ones who get turned in and are incarcerated essentially are the ones who are in the midst of a domestic dispute.
Representative Finkelstein, through the chair. It would take for someone to be unjustly committed, and I think that's what you were alluding to, it would take the collusion of the treatment professional, the family member, and the physician, and the courts. And I think that there are safeguards built in to prevent that from happening. The other side of that coin is certainly the people who are most likely to be committed are those by a family member, or those who the family member can no longer handle for whatever reason. If that, in combination with an appropriate decision on the basis or on the by the physician, by the treatment professional, by the courts, are consistent with that family, then you're going to have a commitment. When they're inconsistent, you're not going to have the commitment. So I think there are some safeguards and checks and balances built in.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. A question to the mental health section of this. Federal funds, will they be coming into this as far as building treatment? I can see a big escalation of treatment facilities coming online. Is that a possibility?
What's
the cost of the 50-50 match with state monies?
There's a possibility that we'll get federal funds down the line for treatment facilities, certainly. And generally, they require some match. Generally, they're in the fashion of block grants. But that is not to speak to the possibility that we would have federal funding that not would be outside of the block grant. So yes. In answer to you, there is possibilities for federal funds.
And one quick more question: Will that also be contained in the upcoming possible legislation for a moratorium on nursing home beds, hospital beds, things like that? I know there is somebody that can probably answer that. But I my concern, other than the fact that I think that you can't treat somebody that doesn't want to be treated, my concern is that it's going to eat up an incredible amount of money at the state for people who do want treatment, who walk in and say, I know you can't treat me now, but put me on the list. And there are people out there that are wanting treatment. And to pick up a group of people that don't want treatment and force them into it 104 times, as you said, to me is I can't even see the reasoning of this. And I think it's unfortunate that we are still batting our heads against the walls for this. But I'm concerned of the cost. Has anybody given me a cost of this, please?
Representative Tui, through the chair, there are fiscal notes attached. There is a fiscal note.
I don't have this.
$50,000 the first year. And basically, it's small because we're not anticipating a great many commitments.
I don't know.
Four zero. Alcohol and drug abuse, $50,000 in FY98, $200,000 on out. Trial court, or the
representative to
trial court, $75,000 a year.
Representative Toohey, through the chair, with response to the cost, we're bearing that cost right now in the emergency rooms and the detox centers and the jails and the police departments. And by the cost-benefit analysis we gave you before, it is, in fact, a cost savings to do it this way. With respect to treatment doesn't work for people who don't want treatment, there is a preponderance of empirical evidence that indicates that nearly everyone that comes forward for treatment is coming forward because they are being coerced either by their families, their court, the job, somewhere. So basically, most people do not want treatment, and success rates are not necessarily positively correlated between a person's willingness to undergo treatment.
And just to answer that quickly, and then I will be quiet again, the day we said we will take this on as a medical problem is the day we made this big mistake, and I've said that before. To me, alcoholism should not be lumped into medical problems. It should be lumped into something other than a disease. It is a personal problem you have, and unfortunately, some people have more of a problem saying no. But that, to me, is our major problem, that we've taken on this care and feeding of a group of people that don't want care and feeding.
Representative Toohey, in all fairness, the alternative is much more dismal than what
certainly
we're doing right now.
Amen.
This bill is an attempt to try to do a little better with the alternative that, quite frankly, the U.S. Supreme Court has brought to us by saying that public intoxication should be decriminalized in the first place. We had a way of treating people who didn't want to be treated. It was called the correctional system. We can't do that anymore. So this bill isn't the enemy. It is something else.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that in mind,
Mr. Chair,
I will stop talking.
Representative Finkelstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't at all disagree with that statement.
I don't either.
But, of course, in the area of drugs, we do still have the correctional system. And I'm just wondering I can see the logic of what we're doing here much better when it applies to alcohol. In the world of drugs, why is it necessary to include that here? When we do have the court system available to us, since we're talking about only applying to legal use.
Representative Finkelstein, through the chair, there is often a situation that will come forward where an individual is incapacitated by drugs, putting himself in harm's way and putting the community in liability, legal liability, by their actions, where an involuntary commitment is an appropriate stance to take. They cannot prove any drug use, or there is no, case to be formed for drug use, but the individual, as you spoke earlier, a person who is on prescription drugs and who is addicted, a person who is on crack cocaine where there is no legal case involved, it is much from a medical standpoint and from a safety standpoint, it's better to put them in a treatment facility than to put them in jail, if in fact you could put them in jail. This does not in any way affect the legal consequences of illicit drug use.
President Finkelstein?
Mr. Chairman, I just say I guess I'm sold on alcohol, though I'm still a little concerned. But in the world of drugs, I do think we have the opportunity to arrest people, to include various treatment requirements as part of the sentence if they are found guilty, and that this approach isn't necessary to address the problem that the chair described with public drunkenness not being against the law.
Just think of the amount of time that the criminal justice system would be saved if an addict successfully went through this system rather than the criminal justice system.
I don't doubt that to be the case. It's just the potential for got such a lower standard here for putting someone into that system that I'm not sure we're ever going to get the right people. Because of the examples mentioned, crack cocaine,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's a proof standard there that if you've got enough for this, you ought to be going for the other. And the other one mentioned prescription drugs. We aren't covering it, you know, assuming you're falling off the seat, you're getting the prescription somehow, which their doctors will keep giving you the prescriptions, so you could be addicted legally. They couldn't get you. So I just think it's, alcohol is such a big thing, it's such a clear thing. These other things are often another world where we have a set of laws to deal with them. I do share the fears that it could get misused, and certainly the top priorities ought to be the alcohol cases. That's the biggest drain on society.
Further discussion? What's the wish of the committee? Representative Green?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that we move CS for House Bill number 493, version G, out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
As amended?
As amended.
We've got a motion to move the bill as amended with fiscal notes. Is there objection? Representative Finkelstein?
Mr. Chairman, can I just ask if anyone would have an interest in an amendment to leave it to alcohol and move drugs? Just leave out alcohol.
Leave out drugs, you mean?
Leave out the drugs. I'd go without it.
I, quite frankly, I would be surprised if very many pure drug abusers got botched into this. What I think this will do is eliminate the debate about how much of my problem is a result of alcohol or how much of it is as a result of my drug abuse problem. At the time of an involuntary commitment hearing, I don't really think that there's going to be that many addicts that run into this. If they do, they're really so far down the tube that they need it anyway. Representative
Davis? Mr. Chairman, he wanted to know who would be interested in it. I would be interested in it, but I think I've been convinced that even though they think this bill might do some things, that it's really not going to do a whole lot. In fact, the people that did the testimony just gave me some relief in the fact that they're saying the people are not really going to be coming into the program at all. It's going to be further down the line, 5-10 years from now. And so if that's the case, if you're saying you got to do all these things to even bring them in on an involuntary basis that way, even though you think this bill might do something, I don't think it's going to do anything. So I don't think we have to worry about that. So for that reason, I'm not voting do not pass. I'm a no rec at this time. Maybe there might be some other work that can be done on the bill, but...
Well, from a standpoint of having some experience in this general area, let me say that my impression of the function of this bill would be that it would be something that's available for the few isolated individual cases that every community has of the guys that have been described that are going through detox 100 times and spending literally thousands of dollars in that process. And instead of maybe giving them the opportunity, because it takes quite a while and it's a different time frame for individuals, but an alcoholic that's been down the alcohol road for a long time doesn't get rational for sometimes 3 months. And a longer period of involuntary commitment can sometimes get a person to that point where otherwise just the cyclic system won't allow it. I look at this as something that's going to help in those kinds of cases, and we don't have an answer for alcoholism. Hell, if we did, we'd do it. You know.
I won't be offering it.
We have a motion to move as described. Is there objection? There's no objection. The bill passes. While we're signing,
we do apologize to that.
What'd you say? Get it on tape.
The next bill is HB 479, immunity from equine activities. Here to tell us what equine means and what the bill is about is Representative Gary Davis.
Giddy up, horsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Representative Gary Davis, representing District 8, Soldotna de Seward. Not necessarily the horse capital of the state, but it's probably fairly close. And of course, equine, similar to Heine,
Mr. Chairman, I mean me forever.
It's in the bill. It's in the bill.
If I might enlighten the committee, Representative Porter was also in Labor and Commerce, and he questioned the definition of hiney, which is in the legislation. Members of the committee, this bill is simply a bill to limit the civil liability of persons who are involved in equine activities throughout the state. There are several exclusions in this, and it's naturally due to the innate nature of equine animals. If a person is not familiar with how to handle the animals, there's opportunity for injury that is certainly no fault of the owners or sponsors of the animals, as indicated in the sponsor statement. Without reading the sponsor statement, that in essence is what the bill does. There are a number of exemptions or exceptions to the legislation. The owners must their gross negligence is naturally an exemption, and
it will be as soon as we do an amendment.
And letting someone who is unfamiliar with the activities participate is also included, and spectators and faulty equipment that is utilized is exempted. And then there's a number of definitions to clarify, help additionally clarify what we're speaking about in the legislation. So in essence, Mr. Chairman, that's the gist of the bill without reading the sponsor statement.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Representative Bundy?
Perhaps a question more to you than the sponsor. I'm just wondering if this is a case of maybe getting the torque before the cart.
Great. Can you have control?
We don't have anyone else to testify. Representative Easy.
Yes.
We just passed it.
Somebody correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't equine a noun?
A noun?
Yeah, isn't equine a noun?
As is horse, I would say it is.
Isn't equestrian an adjective?
No, it's a noun.
Equestrian's a noun?
Yes.
That's an adjective.
Okay, forget that I asked the question. Wrong group.
Yeah, equestrian is it.
I appreciate the...
It's an adjective.
No, yeah. It is a person who rides.
Oh.
That's right.
It can be an adjective, though. Right. It can be used to say, describe the type of activity, like an equestrian activity.
Yes.
Well, then
it
could be...
I think it probably would be more proper.
It could be either one, depending on its usage. Gosh, who's got this, you know, this
so.
English thing? Al does that all the time.
Stop the music.
Yeah. Representative Davis,
Davis.
There's
Davis.
Two Davises here. That's
right.
Right.
Not
me, I'm, I know.
Okay. Gary.
Yes, Brian.
Thank you. We had the discussion, and I'm given to understand that you don't have any great objections to an amendment that would... take out the last half of line 13 on page 1 and line 14.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. I'm a stickler for brevity and simplification, and I believe that serves the purpose and also simplifies the legislation.
With that in mind, Representative Green.
Well, I was wondering if it might be, I hate to usurp any of the...
Oh, all right.
I might offer an amendment.
Well, sir.
All right. I would like to offer amendment number 1 to this, and I would suggest that perhaps on line 11 after the number 1 there that we would insert gross negligence or, and then drop down as you had indicated, and starting with the middle of, or a little beyond the middle of 13, delete the rest of that sentence, starting with for purposes of.
We've had a motion for amendment number 1, which basically amounts to not recognizing the inherent risk of equine activities, but not to include a limitation of liability for gross negligence. Is there objection to that amendment? If not, that is accomplished. What is the wish of the committee?
Chairman.
Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you, Chairman. Just a question for Representative Davis. The it seems like we get a lot of these bills on exceptions for liability. In fact, I remember this one a few years ago. Someone from MATSU was pushing this. I can't remember who. What is it about horse activities that would say that Alaskans who suffer damages, which may or may not be someone else's fault, why should we have an exception for horse activities versus, say, bicycle activities? People do a lot of these same activities with bicycles or snowmobiles or something else. What is it inherent in a horse that means you should have less responsibility for your action than something else?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure there are plenty of other activities out there, and these issues are brought to us, and this one was brought to me by a constituent who deals with equine activities, and we checked it out, and there are a lot of states that have similar laws, and the people that are involved in these activities run across situations that are what I would consider frivolous lawsuits, frivolous from the standpoint of it's outside of their control, and the persons that were involved in the accidents probably should have known better, and a lack of common sense. In other words, it was their fault as opposed to the owner's fault. But really, there's really no, of course, no yes or no answer to your question, and it's just something that's brought to certain person's attention that feels to have some credence to it.
Chair. No further questions? What's the wish of the committee? Representative Bundy?
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill 479 as amended from this committee, attach fiscal notes, individual recommendation.
And a motion to move is described. Is there objection?
Objection. Please speak to Mr. Chairman.
Representative Finkelstein, speaking to objection.
Speak to my objection. I think there's lots of entities out there who'd love to be exempt from our liability laws, and eventually, if we exempt them all, we won't longer have any liability laws. People ought to be responsible for their actions, and I can't see any reason why we should take this action in this particular area. And if we were to take it in this area, I certainly would want to include other trail-oriented sports activities, which are also big in our state. So I'd be opposed to the bill.
Any further discussion? Objection maintained? Can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Davis?
Yes.
Representative Finkelstein?
No.
Representative
Davis? Yes.
Yes.
Yes. CS for 479, Labor and Commerce, now Judiciary, I guess. Passes.
Thank you.
The next bill for consideration is HB 318, Mental Health Directives, Treatment Directives. We have Pat. Pat, what is your?
Clasby.
Here to answer questions if necessary. The first one to testify is Leonard Abel.
Do you want me to make a statement?
Oh, is this your bill? I'm sorry. I'm not that far yet. Yes, it certainly is. Leonard, please join us, and Representative Toohey. Would you please introduce your bill?
That's all right. If with your permission, I will stay right here if that's possible.
Certainly.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman Porter, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak on House Bill 318 today. This bill would allow an individual to make advanced directives regarding his or her mental health treatment. The person would need to be of sound mind when making the declaration, which would designate an attorney in fact who would act only when the individual was determined to be incompatible with the directives would address the use of psychotropic medications, electroconvulsion therapy, and the length of short-term admission, up to 17 days, to a treatment facility. The declaration would be in effect for 3 years unless the individual became incapable. In that case, it would continue in effect until the individual was no longer incapable. While an individual is capable, he or she can revoke the declaration in whole or in part at any time. This declaration gives the individual the opportunity to make his or her wishes known about the treatments, ones that have worked in the past and that would be desired in the future, as well as treatments that have not worked in the past and would not be desired in the future. It provides for a substitute decision maker with whom the doctors would consult should the declaration not be specific enough or should the doctors recommend a treatment not specified. House Bill 318 is similar to an Oregon law. In Oregon, they have found that individuals who have fought hospitalizations and medications in the past now were more willing to go to the hospitals because they had a declaration in place and they felt their decisions would be heard. House Bill 318 is supported by the Charter North Hospital, State Alaska, Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, the South Central Counseling Center, the Alaska Psychological Association, the Mental Health Association in Alaska, and the Mental Health Consumers of Alaska and the Department. There is a zero fiscal note for your, and your support would be appreciated. Dorothy Peavy of the Mental Health Consumers of Alaska is on a teleconference in Anchorage. She is one of my heroes. It was she who approached me about the introduction of this bill. Also, Leonard Abel from the Department, thank you, Leonard, of Social Services here to respond to questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions of the sponsor? If not, Leonard?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Several members of the committee have heard the testimony I'm about to give you one or more times, but if you bear with me, try to go through it again. I think this is a very important legislation. My job is to be the Community Mental Health Services Program Administrator for the Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the department in support of the bill. We very strongly support the bill and feel that it's a very important piece of legislation. Personally, for me, I became interested about 11 years or so ago, 11 or 12 years ago, when I was working at South Central Counseling Center in Anchorage. I had a client who was one of those persons that was unfortunate enough to have schizophrenia, but fortunate enough to be in that group that only has one or two breaks in their lifetime, usually psychotic episodes, and spends most of the time pretty stable. And she was talking to me and asked if there was some kind of a piece of paper that she could sign that would, in case she happened to have that second episode, that would direct her to go to the hospital or get medications. And at that point, as a clinician, I had to say, no, there isn't anything that you can do. What she was trying to tell me, what she knew, is that if her schizophrenia returned, she had another psychotic episode, she was going to lose the ability to think logically, rationally. She would lose the ability to make good decisions about her care, about her treatment. She knew that it was very likely that she would become paranoid, that she would be frightened of anybody who tried to help her, that she knew that she would very likely believe that her medications were poison or some way would harm her, and she's not likely to take them. The result would have been steadily increasing illness until somebody decided that she was a danger to self or others, gravely disabled due to that illness, and put her in the hospital against her will. Then API staff would have gone through days and days of pleading with her, reasoning with her, trying to get her to take some medication. Eventually, she would have stabilized, but left the hospital, and very likely have repeated the episode again. I have seen that happen over and over and over again. A declaration of this type says, in essence, that if I get sick and I've lost my ability to deal reasonably with you, I still want you to help me. I want you to make me take some of the meds or do whatever else is necessary to get me stable. At the same time, it would give her and every other patient in the state the chance to say, Thorazine really makes me sick. Please don't give me that. The chance to say, I really don't want electroshock therapy. These things that have been tried, they have never worked for me. And if she or anybody else then became psychotic, there's a far greater chance that she would not be taken away kicking and screaming, but more willingly enter the hospital. She reached at any stage of becoming incapable. The department looked at this. There should be no extra cost to the system. In fact, as it's pointed out to me after the last time I testified, that maybe there's a negative fiscal note. If we can get people into treatment quickly, a lot of the costs of commitment hearings and side trips to local community hospitals en route to API maybe could be avoided. I think I really strongly urge you to pass this bill. Thank you very much.
Good questions, Representative Green and then Deasy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would ask your liberty to talk about perhaps briefly another bill because of its possible effect on this one. And I would, if that's permissible, I would like to, since you're the sponsor of the other bill, is there any way that if this were passed, it could be construed into a possible bill that would come along for the right to terminate one's life? In other words, if this person is incapacitated, could the attorney, in fact, act in that person's stead for anything other than treatment and not go beyond just administering or not administering certain kinds of treatments or drugs?
Should I try to answer?
Please, I don't know.
The title of the bill is Advanced Directives for Mental Health Treatment, and throughout the language of the bill, it says that the person signing the declaration is making decisions about mental health treatment. I don't think life or death is not mentioned anywhere in the statute.
The title.
Representative Deasy?
Thank you. I've heard this bill. I think this is the third committee I've heard it in. And I still don't understand what we're really hoping to accomplish here. The idea being that a person, any of us, can have assign a power of attorney to somebody. And in our absence or in our presence, that person can conduct our affairs. What we're doing here is we're codifying that power of attorney can't take effect until the person is declared mentally incompetent. So it seems that we're requiring that there be a outside judgment that this feared event has happened. And until it's diagnosed or confirmed by independent parties, the person that holds the power of attorney, who may have intimate knowledge of what the intent of their custodian or custodial person desired was, will not be able to act until there's confirmation that this schizophrenia or this mental illness has set in and you are the person's assigned guardian, since they're now incompetent. That's my interpretation of what we're doing here.
Representative Deasy, through the chair, if we're going beyond my area of competence, I'm not a lawyer, but I think I take a shot trying to answer that. A person may have a guardian. They may have somebody who is a conservator for their cash. That have been appointed by court for very different reasons than what's addressed in this statute. And I don't see this particular piece of legislation as affecting that relationship at all. This is this legislation would appoint a very specific attorney in fact, for the narrow purposes of acting in the person's behalf to acquire mental health treatment. And I think that might address the question you were trying to ask.
Well, my question is a little narrower than that, is that what we are doing here is saying that, as I understand it, is that this attorney in fact cannot step in and act as the individual's guardian until such time as some independent party makes a determination that mental illness has set in and this person is not capable of making decisions. I'm not sure that we're making any big step here. I mean, without this law, you still need this determination that there's mental illness involved and that there's medical help is needed. And anybody can make a list of things saying, this is my medical history, I don't respond well to this treatment, I don't respond well to that treatment. What are we gaining by having a custodian or a guardian with power of attorney to tell these people to the medical professions when, you know, they're perfectly capable of reading a document? Or I'm not sure that I see that we're really doing anything that improves the state of mental health care in Alaska by creating this form of guardianship.
By Mike.
I would disagree with my own statement if that person could act prior to 12 hours or 36 hours of observation or whatever it would take to make a medical determination.
But I believe that is the intent of the statute. It's a lesser level of disability that would allow the attorney in fact to direct the treatment than would be necessary for a commitment hearing. If I understand your question right, so what's the difference between this and commitment? I think it's a lower standard of disability.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Beasley. I think online is Dorothy Peavy, and this woman has the voice of experience. And to correct you, we've only heard this bill twice. This is the second hearing of this bill. I believe it was heard in Health and Human Services, and this is the second committee referral.
It seems like it's a third.
It just seems like a long time. So I beg your apology there. Or accept it. If we could hear from Dorothy Peavy, I think she would help explain this a little better.
Are there any other questions of Mr. Abel?
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Larry. Then could we go to Dorothy Peavy in Anchorage?
Sure. My name is Dorothy Peavy. I am the Executive Director for Mental Health Consumers of Alaska, an organization founded by and for people with mental illnesses. This bill is a response to a lot of need, which we have seen for a long time, giving consumers a means to make their wishes known and have some legal validity to those choices at a time when their decision-making is poor and when their ability to be a good historian is also poor. Currently, there's a standard of incompetency which is determined by a court after a hearing. This would have, as Leonard said, a lower standard. A person would be declared incapable and would be declared that probably locally. If we designed it so that you'd be found incapable by either two physicians, one of whom has to be a psychiatrist, or by a physician and a professional mental health clinician, someone with a master's degree or higher in the mental health services, so that, especially in bush areas, we would be able to, this could be triggered. At that point, then the person authorizes a hospital stay of up to 17 days. It does have a kind of fill in the blank. So the person who fills out the declaration could designate that they only want to be hospitalized for did not desire to be in the hospital. Currently, if a person does not wish to be in the hospital and felt that they need to, then they have to go to court and be committed. If then they still refuse to take their medication, then they have to go to a fourth medication hearing. Both of these hearings tie up a lot of state resources. They tie up a judge, a psychiatrist from usually ABI, but it can be other facilities, a assistant district attorney, attorney general, and a public defender. And it can take quite a bit of time before those hearings, like 72 hours, before those hearings may take place. If you have a declaration filled out, you pretty much have said, I am willing to be given X, Y, or Z medication should I have a relapse. Now, if drug X, Y, or Z are not appropriate, the doctor has a couple of choices. First, he can go to the attorney in fact and have them make a decision about the medication, or they off, if they cannot get permission at that point, then they can decline to provide services unless it's an emergency situation, and then they would just have to use good medical judgment. I would be glad to answer any questions that you have. I'm not sure I can answer Representative Beasy's question, but I should, sure would try.
Are there any questions of Ms. Peavy? If not, thank you very much. We have one other person here in Juneau, Richard Rainey. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm Executive Director of the Alaska Mental Health Board. The board is the state entity charged with advocating for consumers of mental health services. And just very briefly, the board supports HB 318. We think it provides consumers with an instrument of control over their own treatment that they lack currently. And if there are any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Tui.
Thank you, and I appreciate your testimony. Very briefly, we also have Terry Lauterbach, who is the bill director, here to answer if there are any questions on the section of sharing.
Hiding? Oh, there's... Okay.
Thank you very much for
testifying. Well, let me ask Terry or anyone else that's on that has testified in the previous hearing or now. Let me ask. There isn't a definition of sound mind in the bill, and I don't know if there should or shouldn't be. But it seems to me that there's an automatic suggestion of a way to circumvent the intent of this by trying to establish that the person was not of sound mind when they completed the form, i.e. they'd had previous mental health problems or they wouldn't be in this mode in the first place. Is that